Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're West. Now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wiss. Let's take
hey
a ride.
This is Greg
this
with the Brothers Wiss, number 102. Yes, it's been a month, and I'm sure you've desperately missed us. Last week was Thanksgiving here in the U.S., and it was a little bit hit or miss to get everybody together, so here we are. You know, actually, while I'm thinking about it, I was thinking about, you know, we do this every other week, and I'd really like to put out something in between there, and I was thinking about just recording some thoughts I had. So right now I'm building the CCNA course, and as I go, you know, I just kind of run into stuff I find interesting, and I was thinking maybe kind of aggregating all of that into kind of just, more kind of a brain dump at a time. So I'd be curious to see if anybody has any thoughts on that. But beyond that, we have Thomas Kurnick with us. See how I brought it back, Thomas. I brought it back.
Hello, everyone.
And you are all the way from where?
From Slovakia, Middle Europe, planet Earth, Milky Way. However you want to frame it.
Sounds amazing. So here in Texas, in the United States, we do kolaches a lot. And I'm sure, I'm probably not even pronouncing the word properly, but I mean, we've got like... there's some Czech settlements that came here, some like kind of relatively large ones, and they brought kolaches with them. And I'm sure we've Americified them. And I think I've talked about this before, but my wife and I were talking about it the other day, and I was like, I'm pretty sure Thomas said we're doing it wrong. What does a real kolache look like, Thomas?
So it depends. In Czech and Slovakia, kolache, which is the original kolache. Way how to pronounce it, it's actually a group of baked sweets. It's not a single food. So I suppose it will be, it's very nondescript just saying kolache. It's like,
it's like kind of like saying a sandwich. So it could be like a sub, or it could be like
exactly.
Tuna
exactly.
fish, or it could be like any kind of crazy. All right, I get what you're saying.
Well, we're just saying, you know, it's pie. Well, there's so many variants of pie, right?
Yeah. Oh, totally. Because you could have sweet, you could have savory. And I mean, here, that's what we do. We do a lot of meat kolaches, which is basically, it's... Ours is really just kind of like a roll with stuff stuffed inside. And then the fruit ones are generally open top, kind of an open face sort of thing with them, though. I know this is the fascinating content everybody came for. It just popped in my head when I saw you.
Yeah. We're turning into a baking podcast. Let's go.
Oh, dude, you know how much I love Great British Bake Off. But let's get down to business. So we have a new patron. It's Sean Scarfo. And he came in hot. So he's been active in the community, which is nice. And then we also have Jeff Haynes, who's not new, but he's finally vocal. And I thought it was interesting because he was talking about in his background, he actually also owns a hardware store, and he's branching into becoming a Wisp, or I guess he's in a Wisp and just, you know, does both of those at the same time. And I was just thinking how interesting and how varied people's backgrounds are getting into the Wisp stuff. Because I know there's another guy that came, I think he was doing sprinkler systems, and then he transitioned into becoming a Wisp. It's just so funny how many diverse backgrounds kind of lend themselves well to the Wisp environment. I guess, I mean, what is it, like 50% physical, installing, doing things like that, and then the other 50% is kind of IT related? I mean, how would you break it up, Thomas, if you had to give it a percentage one way or the other?
Yeah, like there's a lot of the physical aspect, right? You have to build the infrastructure, you have to climb towers, you have to build micropops, you know, whatever you have. And that requires a very different skill set than, you know, sitting behind the screen and configuring routers and switches. So, and then of course there's everything else that goes into it, right? Electrical, and many times you need to go solar to get an off-grid site and all of that. It's a very varied skill set.
But I think too, right, you have to interface with customers, so you have to have people skills.
Oh yeah, I haven't even touched the like, the sales and the customers and everything else. Well, just on the technical front, it's
if you
already...
think about it, a lot of technical guys don't necessarily have social skills in their repertoire, right?
Some do. Or it's not even that you don't have technical skills. Like for me, for example, at a certain point I just broke and I just couldn't deal with people's... just I don't know how else to call it, just with bullshit, right? It's I was good at it up to a certain point where you know there was that like the peak that I just couldn't go past, and then I just said, okay, screw it, I'm not dealing with customers anymore. I just can't.
I know over time I've noticed that I'm less and less willing to deal with kind of basic troubleshooting and things like that. Like, you know, like a grandma who wants to troubleshoot her PC, you know, or my mom. When my mom calls me for IT support, I'm like white knuckling it to keep it together. Cause it's just, I don't know, man. I just don't have patience anymore. I guess that's one thing that's going out the window for me. The older I get, the more my patience shrinks. So.
Yeah, exactly. That was it with me. Because for example, with me, I came from an MSP background, right? Mm. We used to do servers and infrastructure on site for companies. And yeah, I used to be just completely cool going there on site and dealing with the non-techie people and everything. But yeah, like you said, I just lost the patience. I just couldn't anymore.
Yeah, that's a young man's game.
Yeah, definitely.
So you need to keep cycling in those young guys. And then, you know, as they lose their patience, you promote them up. Maybe that's the skill. So they just got to learn to get cranky faster. But while we mention it, patrons.
So the point is, get cranky, you'll get promoted.
Yeah, I mean, that works for me. Yeah, promoted into incompetence. That's what they say. Yeah. So I'm definitely incompetent where I'm at now. So I'm good. I can stay right where I'm at. Now, with mentioning patrons, we have a Patreon account, patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You go there, you throw some bones at us, you get access to our private Slack where, honestly, everything that's in here today, I built off of this, all these good guys, this discourse. And it's just really good source for me to steal other people's ideas. And I mean, it honestly, I see what other people are dealing with, the problems they're having, and then the solutions other people kind of provide in there. Why not kind of throw that back out into the community? There's a lot of stuff that's in there that I don't put on here because sometimes I don't understand all of it. I'll be the first one to tell you I do a lot of Googling based on what people are talking about. And then also some of it, I don't know, man, it just doesn't like super pertain to me. There's like a lot of fiber stuff, and I don't do a ton of fiber stuff. I mean, there's been, I don't know if you've noticed in that channel, man, that fiber stuff's getting hot lately. There's been a lot of people talking in there. Just like the Cambium channel is getting a lot of chatter, but I don't do a whole lot of stuff with Cambium. So I'm just, you know, I don't put a lot of Cambium things in there, but there's more than just what you hear us talk about. So definitely come and check it out.
I was going to say it's the place where all the cranky people conglomerate, but you sold it much better. I mean, you sold it much better.
Yeah, once you get to the cranky point, then you pop in there. There you go. Oh, man. One more thank you to get out of the way, and that is to ISP Supplies. They hooked me up with an audience. I think I forgot to mention it before, but I wanted to make sure that I mentioned it. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the piece of kit to play with. All right. So you ready to jump in and get to the vegetables?
Let's get cranky.
All right. So I saw something in the Fortinet channel. One of them was Thrift is our resident Fortinet expert, and he was giving a recommendation to somebody. He said stick with 6.0.7. He said wait till 6.2.4 drops to upgrade. I think they're at 6.2.2 right now. He said there's a couple of fixes that are in the way. On the way. So just kind of hold your horses for that, and everything should be good to go. Thomas found an interesting article about the FortiOS and Forti client security issues. I was curious if you would like to elaborate on that, Thomas.
So yeah, there's been some CVEs published, and now that the fixes are publicly available, you know, the everything is out public, but basically, yeah, Fortinet, FortiOS, FortiClient had a security issue where where certain traffic from certain features was encrypted using XOR encryption with a static encryption key, which is just about as horrible as you can get for encryption. I've read into this quite a bit because I thought this was a very serious issue. It is still a issue, but so luckily it only pertains to a particular feature set of FortiOS. So to be exact, what is actually affected by this is any information that's submitted through Fortinet spam filtering service, the cloud service, any data that is submitted through FortiGate antivirus and anti-spyware and filtering algorithms that they have to their cloud service is also vulnerable. So basically you can leak and you can read a lot of statistical data through just passive listening to traffic of, you know, what the clients are browsing, what they are doing, emails that are being submitted to spam, etc., etc. What is the little bit scary part about this is, since you control the encryption basically algorithm, because it's, you know, it's XOR and it's static keys, you can inject traffic back into those back into FortiGate client and back into those FortiGate OS devices. So this can be used super easily to kickstart many different attacks against FortiGate OS devices and against clients running FortiGate client, which is super scary because you can submit a lot of the data to basically the appliance or the device or the client to kickstart many different attacks. Now, these attacks vectors have not yet been very well researched or tested. There is, of course, POCs. You can try it. It works. You can read the data. You can send the data back to the original client. So just, it's a really big security blunder. Like, this is as bad of an encryption as you can choose. There is just about nothing worse you can do on encryption side other than not encrypting the traffic. So luckily, as I mentioned, to summarize, it's limited to a few features within FortiOS and FortiGate client, but still heavy, super heavy recommendation to immediately patch. Well, or as Andrew said, to patch to proper versions as soon as they are available.
So is this to effectively utilize this exploit, is it man in the middle? I mean, do you have to accept the traffic and pass it on, sort of thing, to inject that in?
If you wanted to inject traffic, yes, you would have to man in the middle the traffic. If you just wanted to passively read the traffic, of course, you could just, you know, listen and do nothing. But yeah, you would have to man in the middle to utilize the attack vectors of injecting traffic to the appliances, you know, devices and the clients.
Gotcha. But just to gather intelligence, you could mirror the traffic, capture it, and decrypt
it. Passive listening would give you a bunch of data on the client. Well, there are some other ways to get similar data, but, you know, any attack vector that gives you more data on the client is still bad and should be fixed as soon as possible.
Gotcha. So it's not the worst thing in the world, but it's definitely something to look out for on update side once it's available, right?
Yeah, definitely should be patched, but it's not super, you know, it's not the end of the world.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, we've seen a lot worse. Of course, we've seen.
Yeah, we've seen a lot worse. We've seen a lot worse, but still, you know. So actually, what maybe is the bad thing about this is that it took Fortinet 18 months to fix this.
Right. So this has been known pretty much for a while. Then.
This has for a long while, and so this has been out in the wild for 18 months since the researchers originally found it. It took 18 months for Fortinet to fix it. While they were fixing it, it was under embargo, so nobody could disclose the details. But this is the scary thing, right? First of all, that somebody or that XOR encryption with a static key was somehow approved and shipped into a production, you know, security appliance and product. You know, how does that happen? That speaks to, well, to some process or policy issue that allowed that to happen. And second of all, you know, 18 months turnaround on a security issue is quite bad.
Do you think, well, I mean, as you mentioned, the idea that that algorithm was introduced to begin with, do you think this process is just really old, like it's been there for a long time, or it's a newly introduced thing? Do you think that they chose that encryption because it was something easily to implement and test, you know, when they were developing the product, and it just never migrated to something better?
Very hard to say. Like, yeah, XOR encryption is as old as as computers themselves, pretty much, right? And specifically the static key, right? It's super easy. You just do some bitwise logic, specifically the XOR, which is not OR logic, right, on the bits using a static key. And so it's super easy. It's super simple. It's not computationally expensive, but at the same time, you know, it's super easy to decrypt, right? And how it got in there, I'm completely, I don't know. It shows the lack of, like, analysis and security best practices, but I wouldn't pretend to know what's happening.
Yeah, maybe it was a placeholder. They got it working, and then the guy who was developing it quit, and then the next guy just didn't pick up on it, something like that.
Yeah, that should never happen.
Stuff like that always interests me. It's, you know, not that it happened, but what were the steps, you know, that kind of led to that unfortunate mishap? That always perplexes me, because I mean, those are the pieces you never actually hear about, but always I like to speculate and see if I'm right or not. So let's see, let's move on to another hardware vendor. How about MikroTik? It's not like we ever talk about MikroTik, so let's go ahead and get that out there. They did the newsletter number 92, and to be perfectly honest, I was kind of underwhelmed. Not that that's bad, I just, you know, it's none of this stuff really hits my use case. There's a lot of stuff on LTE6, which they're obviously pushing that, right? Because they're really getting heavy in the telecom stuff over there in Latvia, right?
Yes.
And they're doing a lot with Latvian telecom, so that makes a lot of sense for folks that are interested in all that. They did the CubeLite 60, which looks like about the same form factor as the SXT squares, but it's just kind of extruded out. You know, they grabbed the extruder tool and they pulled it down to make it thicker. I guess
it's an actual cube now.
Yeah,
as the name would suggest.
It kind of looks like those little Jellos you get, those little individual packed ones. Delicious. But it's about $70, 60 gigahertz. They're saying it gets better throughput than the previous model, or not better throughput, better distance than the previous one. They're saying up to 800 meters point to point and point to multi point, 500 meters. It's a good price point. Looks like good throughput. The only downside is it's got a 100 meg interface on it. So the most you can ever do through things is 100 megabits.
And actually, I was because people on Facebook were making fun of this. Like, I don't get why it's got the light in its product name.
Yeah, that's right there.
MikroTik confirmed that there will be a non-light version with a gigabit port. So this is specifically a low-price CPE, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of a little bit taken back that people were making fun of this on Facebook, like, okay, it's the light version. Of course, it's going to be 100 megs. All the light versions of all the MikroTik are 100 megs. Yeah. That's the point, right?
Yeah, and I'm not being disparaging. I would love to see a $70 device that does a gig. Who wouldn't want to see that, obviously?
Yeah, on the flip side, I actually think that it's amazing that, you know, for $70, this is an amazing CPE to do 60 gig deployments.
Yeah, and I mean, I think people... maybe aren't looking at it in the right light, right? $70 gets you a CPE that's not going to be susceptible to the 2 gigahertz interference or the 5 gigahertz interference, right? You know, even if it's a really trash spectrum like we get in our dense urban populations here, if you just want to do a quick point-to-point between buildings or something like that, it's a very inexpensive way to do that without having to worry about the interference from all of those other users in the area. And I mean, I'm assuming this still uses kind of the beam forming and all of the good stuff like that too, right?
I actually don't know what kind of an array or an antenna they are using in it, so I don't know if that information is public yet or not.
Yeah, all right, well, we'll hear more about it. Other than that, they talked about Linus Tech Tips is using a MikroTik switch, and
oh God, don't get me started.
Yeah. Some people seem to think that was problematic. God. I've never even heard of the guy, but everybody else apparently has. So.
No, it's like it's good that MikroTik is getting some more mainstream, you know, marketing, you could say, just if you watch the video, I actually watched it and I cringed hard the entire way. And it's like,
You have, like, the burden of knowledge. It's hard to remember what it was like being introduced to this and not knowing anything about it. So
No. It's that's not the point of the Linus Media Group, right? What they do is they are very, very consumer oriented. They don't really have any technical knowledge, and that's not their thing, right? That's not their thing. each time or any time you watch a video from them on any server stuff or, you know, professional grade, enterprise grade stuff or networking, God forbid, you can see they have no idea what they are talking about, which, again, you know, that's not their target. That's not what they do. So I suppose it's okay. But still, watching that video was just painful. It showed lack of any basic research or any basic networking knowledge other than, you know, we plug cables and things show us a number on screen, which, again,
that's the lane they're in, right? That's the audience they're chasing. I get you.
Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of a, from a technical standpoint, it was painful, but then again, it's super nice to see MicroTik expanding into that segment.
Yeah, branching out onward and upward. Something I found interesting as well, not about that article, but something else in MicroTik news, is there's a Russian podcast called linkmeup.ru. And obviously, I don't speak Russian, so I can't speak to the validity of it, but they had a few points. Bullet points up about what they had talked about. They actually had a representative from MicroTik themselves, which to my knowledge is the first time that that they've done that kind of thing. Have you heard about them talking with anybody else?
Not that I know of.
All right. Who was it? It was one of the Sergeys, I think. Let me translate. Sergey Boginsky? Technical support engineer for 15 years, marketing organizer of MUM, including Russia. But some of the bullet points they had on there were switch platform in progress, wait for new features and performance, most correct VLAN configuration by bridge configuration, all their approaches will be removed in time. MicroTik has plans for VXLAN, SD-WAN, NGFW, and that's new next-gen firewall, which I think is interesting. I think I said something like 10 years ago, it'd be interesting if they had additional modules, right? So when you hear NGFW, what do you think about?
I get mixed feelings. Because right today that everything's encrypted, end-to-end encryption, it means any kind of, well, not any, but typically what next-gen firewalls do is they have to decrypt that traffic and proxy it, so man in the middle that traffic. And I have quite mixed feelings about that. So on one side, I completely understand the need for, you know, workplace and corporate security and monitoring and everything else. On the other side, I don't know if the networking layer and breaking the networking protocols is the best way to implement that, right? And I get it's not a simple topic, right? With specifically with the bring your own device trend and, you know, zero trust security principles and everything else. You know, if you don't control the endpoint, then the networking layer is the only layer where you can actually do anything about the traffic coming in and leaving your AS, let's call it AS, right? Basically. So I get mixed feelings about this. Normally, I would say just implement anything you want on the endpoint. I don't think networking layer, as I said, breaking and man-in-the-middling protocols, which weren't ever made to be man-in-the-middle. I don't know if that's the right way. So, yeah.
I get it. So you're really more talking about doing inline, threat detection? So looking for malware and things like that, right? But if it's all encrypted, don't you have to decrypt it to see those things, right?
Well, it's not just that. Even if you want to do like data exfiltration. Protection, right? Mm-hmm. Things like that. Basically anything, anytime you want to look at the data today, you have to decrypt the data stream because of those end-to-end encryption protocols that are everywhere today. And yeah, that brings many implications and many different views and angles to the topic, so it just gets real complex real fast.
Yeah, and it seems like with SD-WAN and NGFW, everybody's got a different definition of what that really means, every vendor.
Yeah, it's
so what their implementation will look like, who knows? Maybe it's just going to be like a IPS IDS sort of thing, or maybe they'll have some kind of third-party integration for being able to do some kind of, I mean, who knows, right? Everybody's got a little different flavor.
Yeah, it's yeah. It's very hard to say what they mean and what features that they mean, or even when something like this will happen, right? And in what fashion, who knows?
It's interesting to think about. Let's see, what else do they have? User manager in RedOS version 7 will become advanced RADIUS server. It's interesting. MPLS is in progress for RedOS version 7. Version 7 is very good stuff. WireGuard and TACX, TACX Plus are not in plans. I wouldn't imagine they would support TACX and TACX Plus, but they're already good with RADIUS.
I don't even see why they would need it. And probably there will be people screaming at me, oh, I use TACX all the time, it's so much better and all that. But honestly, yeah, everything that is already available in the MikroTik RADIUS client completely covers all of my needs. Like, the last major hurdle that I had was that IPsec didn't have integration into RADIUS, but that has been fixed for over almost 2 years now, I think. So, you know, these days, just about everything has proper RADIUS integration, so I don't see the need.
Mm-hmm. I just see Mike join. He shouldn't talk until he joins the TriCast and enables that. Otherwise, I'll have to punch him. So, speaking of TACX and TACX Plus, I actually implement TACX Plus. I use the Cisco ACS system, so all of our Cisco kit. You know, I mean, the good part about that is it logs every user who logs in, but it also logs every individual command that user puts in, right? So I guess there's some authentication there. But then we point all of our MikroTiks towards it, and they just use RADIUS. And to be honest with you, I don't feel like I've gotten great benefit out of being able to see individual commands that a person puts in versus just individual user authentication, right? To me, it seems like figuring out what somebody typed in is just trying to assign blame to somebody. And again, I'm sure, like you said, somebody's going to yell at me for saying that, but I can just look at the commands that were entered after somebody logged in, you know, using Unimus. I can see the diff at the end of the day. So it really, I don't know. I don't know that I necessarily really feel that TACX is a necessity for me, even in my environment. Of course, I don't have that many engineers. I really have 3 active engineers and then a couple of other guys that do stuff very occasionally. I just haven't had any problems. Maybe if you've got, you know, 60 engineers across your enterprise, yeah, maybe in that instance that makes sense, you know, where you'd really want to watch stuff like that.
Honestly, at a point where you want to investigate individuals' commands that individuals' user ran, the problem probably already happened somewhere completely different, right? In the lack of planning, in the lack of change management processes, in the lack of preparation, in the lack of validation and testing. You know, there's, yeah, like you said, it's probably when you're looking to assign blame to someone, or you know, if you are even investigating what was done, well, probably you should have some processes or some rules or some policies that would prevent something like that from ever happening in the first place.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know.
Well, maybe if you're like a big telco, you know, and you're publicly traded or something like that, and, you know, there's an RFO that needs to come through, you need to be able to really unequivocally say these are the exact steps that happened at these times. And maybe that makes sense. I don't know. It doesn't. It's not
but
a thing for me.
Then, you know, there's auditing for that, right? Each, like, even in MikroTik, you have complete audit log, you have history, you have everything else. You can set up, you know, logging to a syslog or to internal memory or whatever you want, right? Typically, this would, of course, be syslog. And, yeah, you can log individual commands entered by users if you want to, sure. You just don't do it through your AAA system. You do it through your logging and syslog system.
Now that I'm looking at WireGuard, that's familiar. Isn't that like kind of a VPN sort of technology?
So, yeah, WireGuard these days is actually in the kernel. So MikroTik upgrading to a newer enough kernel, you know, they wouldn't even have to do anything to have it functional and working.
What do they say on their website? It says aims to be faster, simpler, leaner, and more useful than IPsec while avoiding the massive headache. It intends to be considerably more performant than OpenVPN.
So, yeah, it uses public keys. It uses SSH. well, not necessarily SSH as a protocol. It uses SSH keys, to be exact. It can use SSH as an authentication and to build the tunnel, and then inside of, because SSH is a tunneling protocol, actually. Many of us know it for a CLI protocol, but SSH in itself is actually a tunneling protocol, and then you can multiplex multiple different sessions within the SSH tunnel. Right, one of those sessions can be a shell, another can be a file transfer through SCP, right? There is the exec channel within the SSH. So SSH is a very flexible in itself, it is just a tunneling multiplexing protocol to carry different sessions. To bring it back to WireGuard, it's a very new, very simple VPN that's built into the Linux kernel. And for MikroTik to bring support to routers, you would think they would just need to enable the proper kernel modules and then make a front end to it, but apparently they just don't want to invest the time. And I suppose it might be challenging to compile those kernel modules for all of the devices that they support, specifically Tailera.
Well, I guess you focus your energy where you think it'll be most useful, and if this isn't, because I know they're going gangbusters over there with version 7, so I assume they're less inclined to start working on entirely new protocols as opposed, well, not that it's new to them and their platform, as opposed to just getting everything up and working right now. Perhaps that they say not in plans. Maybe that's just because they've got so many other things to implement first. It's not even
honestly, I am a huge IPsec person, and fan. I have done a lot with IPsec. So personally, for me, I would be much happier if they focused on IPsec and specifically brought in support for VTI for IPsec. That would be my dream come true. So yeah, if it means I get VTI, then forget WireGuard.
Well, what is VTI and how is that an advantage?
So it's virtual tunnel interfaces. So basically, normally when you do IPsec in tunnel mode, policies are what drive or what select which traffic goes to the IPsec process and then which peer is the encrypted traffic sent to. So when you build an IPsec tunnel, you don't have an interface like you have with L2TP or GRE or any other tunneling protocol. With IPsec, you don't have an interface. What dictates the traffic is the policy. So you don't even use the routing table. You use the policy table. You use policies to drive traffic forwarding selection into the IPsec process. So what VTI, virtual tunnel interfaces, bring in is that now those tunnel mode connections in IPsec would actually present themselves as actual interfaces to the operating system. So just like with L2TP, each client would be a dynamic interface. But the fact that it's an interface allows you to do things like running OSPF on that virtual tunnel interface or doing any other things which you can do with an interface, running scripts when the interface come up and down. Basically, whatever that requires an interface to function on currently in router OS will not work with IPsec in tunnel mode. And VTI would enable that. And I would be very happy if that happened.
Gotcha. And so that that also helps with things like packets that have do not fragment bits set and the MTU is going to be too large, right? It helps having an actual virtual interface. If it hit the router and it had to squeeze through an interface that was too big, it would be able to intercept that and communicate properly with the client, right? But right now, whenever you send like a 1500 byte packet with do not fragment, you try and go over the internet, there's no virtual interface to know that, right? So you end up having problems. That's where you introduce mangle rules that can reset, do not fragment, and you could try. It just gets more complicated, right?
And there's many angles to go at this. Even having something like Torch directly on an IPsec client would be amazing.
Yeah, that'd be easy.
Yeah.
That'd be so much. And then, yeah, like you said, there's virtual interfaces for everything else, and there's so much flexibility associated with those interfaces. It would be really nice to. And also, when you're talking about policies, you have to. What does Cisco call it? They call it interesting traffic. In the policy, you put interesting traffic that will get pumped into IPsec and encrypted right across. And so you have to, especially in Cisco world, you have to make sure that those lists match up very well on both sides and all that stuff. But whenever you're using a tunnel interface, you basically just say, hey, from point A to point B, anything that's moving through this tunnel, just encrypt it. And it's so much more simple than if you have a complex network, you have to start picking out little bits and pieces and all those things.
It would probably change completely how IPsec is configured on MikroTik again, because I don't know if they would want to keep the policies as they are right now, or if they actually want to migrate that to some virtual routing, you could say, you know, because this is an interface, you could create a route on it, right? And then IPsec could just be picking up things from the routing table, maybe. But then again, what, you know, it's dynamic interfaces, right? And clients can come and go as they please. So there is, and then again, that's that integration, like we mentioned, you know, just making Torch work on some, you know, VTI interface is, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into this. So I'm not surprised MikroTik hasn't done this yet, although there have been requests for this on the forums and everywhere else for years. And I'm hoping at some point VTI will come in, because it would certainly make my life a lot easier, because we do a lot of IPsec.
Mm. True dat. So let's see, what else do they have? They say active PoE not in plans too. It's kind of vague. I'm not sure if they're talking about on the switching line or... standardize that on the products like the HAPAC squared. While you can PoE power them, it's passive PoE, right? You can't do like AFAT stuff.
Yeah,
like
I don't know, because the CRS3 series already have the PoE switches, have, you know, AT and AF and passive output on their ports. So who knows what was meant by that?
Yeah, it could be anything. Let's see what else. High availability and course about it in progress. He says, I wait for stacking. I would wait for MC lag instead of stacking. Hopefully that'll be a thing. High availability. That could be lots of stuff. I mean, you could be talking about like first hop redundancy, or, you know, networks with a lot of redundancy built into them with OSPF and things like that. Or, I mean, you know, whatever. What else does he say? Small amount requests about IPv6, so work with it, not in priority now. I guess that's their way of saying, MikroTik's way of saying that if you don't email them about IPv6 support issues, it gets moved to the back of the list, where apparently
it's right. This one I am a little bit angry about. I mean, come on. Like, the fact that people don't request it doesn't mean there shouldn't be work on it. Because at the point where people will want to use it and MikroTik doesn't have the feature set, you know, they're screwed. So to me, it sounds really stupid to say, oh, you know, people aren't talking about this, so let's not do it. Like, there is no, you know, if on IPv6. It's when. Specifically, go ahead.
I'll say, like, if somebody has already given up on you because you haven't done anything for 5 years, they're not going to keep requesting all the time. You know, they asked 5 years ago, you didn't do it, they moved on. So, they're not going to see requests for things, because people that wanted it bad enough, they left for free-range routing, or they left for Ubiquiti, or they left for Cisco, or Juniper. And so, it's one of those things where you have to make a decision to roll out things that are important based upon things that are important, not necessarily based upon what your users ask for. You know, look at what was it, DEC, the, you know, hardware manufacturer back in the 80s. They went out of business because they built only what their users wanted, not what they should have been building. Well, everybody else built what they should have been building, and, you know, their core user base just kept getting smaller because they just catered to what they wanted and didn't look at the whole market. This is an example. You know, IPv6, it's very important. It should be, feature parity where appropriate with IPv4. Nothing less. Like, that's the feature request. IPv6, feature parity, nothing less.
And, yeah, if they don't do it, it's at the point where people will start asking for it. That's too late, right? You have lost those customers because, like Mike mentioned, they have a need that's not being fulfilled by MikroTik at that point, so they will just buy something that fulfills that need. They won't wait for another 5 years for Microtik to fix this.
Well, I mean, and also, too, you got to think about, there's got to be some fairly sizable telcos that at some point in some countries, maybe not the U.S., maybe other regions, something like that, will say, all right, we're going to be doing this massive rollout, this massive deployment. We're going to need 20,000 pieces of kit. Let's evaluate everything we see. These are the ones that meet our requirements. And if Microtik doesn't meet it, they're not going to send a report request to Microtik and say, hey, can you add this? They're just going to pick up whatever product fits the bill, meets their requirements, and they'll move on, right? So theoretically, if Microtik already has those features, you know, that parity, like you're talking about with IPv4, then, you know, they'd be ready for that kind of, system. What do they say? Chance favors a prepared mind, right? So if you're ready to go, you know, then
so
have better luck.
Microtik has actually, I'm sorry, I have to say it. Microtik has actually alienated. Alienated a large part of the IPv6 users already, because they have had the so there is a bug which is very well known to Microtik and to everybody that's running Microtik OSPF V3. So there is a bug in Microtik OSPF V3 with redistribution of /128 addresses. And it's a specific bug. You can look on it on the forums and everywhere else. It basically makes IPv6 OSPF V3 unusable, completely unusable in certain use cases where people require this. And this bug has been documented and on the forums and talked about to Microtik for at least 5 years. At least. I know this because I hit this bug 5 years ago when we were originally implementing IPv6 on our network. And I emailed and they said, yeah, we know about this, it's a known issue, it will be fixed in version 7. I don't know if it's fixed in version 7, but so you already see that basically all of those users that were hitting the bug, it was a showstopper. It means they had to replace Microtik kit with something else. So imagine how many users this already alienated over the last 5+ years. So no wonder there is no, you know, users talking about it. Well, a large part of them already left because OSPF V3 wasn't working with /128 redistributions in those specific use cases, you know. And so to me, this is just really short-sighted, and That's all I can say.
That's interesting. So was it like your loopbacks on your routers?
Like, yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. They wouldn't be able to be redistributed.
Yeah, exactly.
That sucks. I also saw Thrift posted a little snapshot from a forum post. So I'm not sure which forum post it was, but a Microtik rep said, we are researching ways to implement MCLag. So there you go. The MCLag versus stacking debate. They're saying that they're researching how to implement MCLag. So something perhaps on the horizon. Let's, you ready to move on to another manufacturer?
Let's go.
All right. So let's talk about Ubiquiti for a minute. They put out the Amplify Alien. It looks like that tube they put out not too long ago, only it's black and green. And I think the Alien comes from, it super reminds me of the old Alienware kit. You remember that stuff? The green alien head glowing. It looks like their version of that. So I'm guessing that's where the alien comes from.
I think that's what they were going for with the promotional materials. It was the same lighting, same like picture setup, you know, black with the green lighting. You know,
yeah, and that used to exemplify, right, like cutting edge of gaming and things like that. So I could see them.
Maybe Ubiquiti will sue Dell now for copyright infringement and racketeering.
for using their promotional idea 10 years before they came up with it.
Yes.
All right. Well, you never know. So the Alien does have some new technology in there. It's 802.11ax Wi-Fi 6 capable. It's got several radios.
What does that mean, capable?
Well, I mean, it's capable of doing it, apparently, whether you have a piece of equipment that can take advantage of that or not. You know, you probably don't right now.
I mean, does it mean that it has the hardware inside and the software doesn't support it yet?
It says it's got two 5 gig radios. One, it says 8x8, Wi-Fi 6. So it looks like the hardware's in there. A 2.4 radio that's 4x4. And then they've got a 5 gig radio that's going to be 4x4. So what does that mean? The 8x8 is for meshing, maybe? And then the
no, it's, I'm just wondering, you know, the hardware might be there, but if they are specifically saying, you know, capable in their materials, maybe this is a feature that will come with time into the software, if you know what I mean. By
sure.
it now, it has the hardware. Maybe the software stack will, you know, enable this with the firmware.
Right. Well, if you look directly at the product page, however, it doesn't say capable in there. It just says that it does it. So I guess it depends on what you're looking at, where you're looking at it. Performance backwards compatibility with Wi-Fi, previous standards, all the normal stuff. 4-port gig, switch on there, touchscreen display, amplify, teleport configuration free VPN solution. So, it looks like it's retailing for about $380.
Ouch.
Pretty pricey.
Yeah, it's extremely pricey.
And that's something that I sort of raise an issue with is their usage of the term Wi-Fi 6. Wi-Fi 1.2.3.5.6 is relevant to the Wi-Fi Alliance and specific Wi-Fi certifications, not an IEEE standard. So unless they've been certified by the Wi-Fi Alliance, this has nothing to do with Wi-Fi 6. It's just 802.11ax. You know, Wi-Fi Alliance certifies something as being a Wi-Fi device. There's extra interop and whatnot testing that goes in to make sure that your product isn't a pile of crap.
Well, it says Wi-Fi 6 technology and Wi-Fi 6 performance.
Sure.
It doesn't necessarily say that it's
anything else. But for a company that's so hung up on courtrooms and cease and desist, they sure are dancing on that line pretty good themselves.
What do they say? Sometimes it's better to do something and ask for forgiveness later.
And sue someone later.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's the first product from one of our favorite manufacturers that actually, you know, says that it's supporting 802.11ax. So that's interesting to see the hardware starting to hit the. Oh man, can you still call UniFi stuff commodity market? I was gonna say commodity networking equipment. You know, just because it's less expensive than your major guys. You know, it's almost like. Calling someplace a third world country. A third world used to be, if you weren't America or Russia, you were a third world. And that's not necessarily the case anymore, right? I think America's almost a third world now. You count China and some of the other economies out there. I think UniFi, $380 price tag, that's not small. And
But are there any other Wi-Fi 6 devices out there?
Yeah. I mean, nobody has any kit that can actually take advantage of that yet, right? Doesn't mean
there are a few laptops that already have 6 cards.
Okay. Is it maybe the new MacBook that came out not too long ago?
Unlikely.
I don't think, not Apple, but those, you know, high-end gamery laptops and all that actually has 6 stuff in it.
Hmm. You got me. I don't know anything about Apple products other than occasionally they're annoying. Like, who was it? Zach was talking about he was having random disconnect issues. He was trying all kinds of stuff, like with the band steering, turning that off and on and all this stuff. It turns out in the UniFi, you can change the DTIM setting to 3, and it magically fixed all of his Apple products. And if you do a little looking around on their forums, you see a lot of people suggesting the same thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of magic. For example, with Microtik, you have to make sure that... oh my god, what's the name of that setting? Oh, I have to check. Give me a second.
Gotcha. So while Thomas is clacking on some keys, DTIM is Delivery Traffic Indication Message. So it looks like, because I'm having to read on an Aruba post that gives a little bit more information about it, but they're basically saying that clients, you know, wireless clients like your phone and things like that will go into a sleep mode for a while. It kind of waits for unicast packet to wake up and all that stuff, and there's an interval at which it will do that. And if you change the DTIM, it defaults to 1, which means like every ARP packet will kind of send out to the clients and can wake them up, right? So the idea being, if you delay it a little bit, you'll get some extended battery life, and apparently adjusting that fixes Apple devices.
So. Yeah, so on MikroTik, there is a specific thing. Preamble mode has to be set to both. If you set this to short only, Apple devices will not connect.
But it defaults to both, right?
Yeah, it defaults to both, but people like to switch it to short because they feel like it will improve Wi-Fi performance because, you know, short is better than long, right? But, yeah.
Well, not always.
Yeah, not always, exactly.
If you set it to both, if the device supports short, it'll use it. But if it doesn't, it'll go ahead and use long, right?
Yeah. And so the thing is, during the four-way handshake, Apple devices only use long preamble and they switch to short after. But if you force short, they won't be able to handshake.
Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, and so I did a little digging. So you can change that in Unify. And so I thought, hey, can you change the DIM in MikroTik, and you cannot. I see people on the forum saying they've been asking MikroTik for it. I don't know that it's necessarily a showstopper, because I haven't run into this particular problem on MikroTik. Not for a while. I remember I did for a minute, but haven't seen it for a while. So.
Yeah, like MikroTik Wi-Fi, especially the newer chipsets for me, have been pretty stable and doing fairly good with just about all types of clients when it's configured correctly. And not just used out of the box with the default settings, but when you actually, you know what you're doing and configure it properly, but then there is no issue.
That's what I was saying. That's all we need is more knobs in MikroTik Wireless.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, like,
I get pretty lost as it is now.
Like the 100 options that are in there aren't enough.
No. Oh, my God.
Is this the first feature that, or the first knob that Unify has that Ubiquiti does not, or that MikroTik does not have? Because Ubiquiti, Unify is devoid of knobs.
Oh yeah. True story. But I didn't even think about it like that. It very well may be.
You'd think, right, Unify being Unify, they would just detect the MAC prefix of Apple devices and just set it for all Apple devices automatically to the correct value. Like, it's not that hard. You know the MAC address prefix of Apple equipment, just do it.
There's lots of things that aren't that hard that are not being done in Unify.
That's very true.
Mm. Since we did tangent to Unify, I wanted a further tangent on some things I've been looking up here. So Ubiquiti Wi-Fi Alliance certifications. They have five. The original Unify AP, the original Unify AP Pro, the Unify AC Pro, the Unify Nano HD, and the Unify InWall HD. No other device is even in the Wi-Fi Alliance database. So that's how seriously Ubiquiti takes Wi-Fi on their products that they banter Wi-Fi.
And yet they sell bajillions of them, so it doesn't seem to be too big an issue. That's like not so long ago, every data center said that they were like Tier 4 designed or Tier 3 designed, but they weren't actually going to the Uptime Institute and getting those certifications or anything. So then everybody started getting cease and desists, and subsequently I think the Uptime Institute doesn't even really exist anymore, or at least give those certifications out. So it's sort of difficult when people are talking, well, what kind of data center do you have? You can't, like, it used to be kind of a sort of easy way to show people sort of where you're at, but you can't say that anymore. So you have to be like, we're concurrently maintainable. We've got blah, 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 blah. Whereas it used to be like Tier 4 design. So it's become very complicated. Anyway, so speaking of Unify 2, I, at one of the airports, had a problem. This was a million years ago, but we haven't talked for a million years. So there you are. We had issues with one of my Unify APs. People said that they were having Wi-Fi problems. And so the first thing I did was say, how long has it been going on? They said, oh, about 3 months. I was like, you're just now telling me? This is crazy. So we went out there. We put some probes in. I put not one, but I put two MikroTiks. I put a couple of Haplites in there. And I had them both connect to the AP in question. And you could do in the connection list, you can like force them to go to a specific AP, and I did that. Then I put IPs on them, and I pinged them, and I pinged the Unify radio, and I pinged all the things everywhere. And I noticed that the clients never disconnected, but every so often they would just lose. I would just lose pings for 30 seconds to both of them simultaneously, right? So I was thinking, if you just have one probe in there, you know, they could be false positives, you could be blah, blah, blah. Subsequently, I changed that out for another AP, but then somebody in the Slack said, hey, if you're running these on the Gen 1s, the old ones, on 4.0.54, you need to roll back to 4.0.42 because we had those same problems. Anyway, I had already thrown the thing in the trash at that point. But we went with the new Unify AP Pros, would have the 5 gigahertz radios in there as well. And so I put... what did I put in there? I put half AC squareds in there so that I could connect to the 2 and the 5 and, you know, do all the ping and stuff. And I noticed that it did get significantly better. That fixed virtually everything. But I was still having a little bit of simultaneous problems with the 2.4. And then I found out where we had our probes. It was right next to, like, you know, so in the airport where they make kind of like the little food and stuff, it was right next to their microwave. I was like, oh, yeah, that's the... So every time they microwaved a burrito, it would drop out. So that was kind of... I don't know why that didn't occur to me to begin with. But the 5 gig has been doing really well. So I just... I was thinking, that's... If you were to approach this, how would you normally go about it? And for me, I needed some thing to put out there. And, I mean, I could have done it with... you know what? Like a half AC... light or something that could go to the 5 and the 2, because it's not like you need throughput, you just need to test whether stuff's coming up or not, and then you can log into them and see if they disconnected from the AP, all that stuff. So it really, it gave me everything that I conceivably needed, and I control the whole environment, so I knew it wasn't like a spectrum issue necessarily. It was more a firmware issue on an old radio. Come to find out too, they had done upgrades and buried the radio in the wall, so that was kind of problematic as well. But how would you guys approach
all the old radio behind the
volition? Yeah, it's magic. So we had to abandon.
I'm sure it was there and it's still broadcasting.
Oh, I mean, it's still there now. We had to ban it in place because it was literally sheetrock behind a wall. I was just curious, how would you guys go about it? Because my first thought was, I need a probe. I had to have something out there, and I couldn't think of anything better than just putting a little microtik out there that I could tuck away somewhere and, you know, just connect to. I could VPN into it and try and replicate experiences, things like that. What would you guys do?
Personally, I would go the same way, put out the probe, but I would put up a Raspberry Pi in there just to be able to run some monitoring, to have long-term graphs and, you know, results. And, for example, cache data when it's offline. So specifically, of course, I would do NetXMS, and yeah, NetXMS agent can cache data when it's disconnected and then push it to the server back after the server connection resumes for, you know, post outage analysis. So maybe I would run some script that would actually do, you know, spectral scans and scan the spectrum and everything else and cache all of that data and send it back to the monitoring server after, so I could actually look like if there was a disconnect, you know, what was happening during the disconnect. Did I still see the SSID that I was interested in and blah blah blah. But yeah, I would go very much the same route. Just personally, I would put the Raspberry in there to have a little bit more flexibility and you know, how I collect and structure the data and visualize the data.
Fair enough. I also found out that every so often there's military planes that fly in that have equipment designed to jam wireless signals whenever they land and or take off. I thought that was fun. It's,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it's another one I can't really control. There you go. All right, moving right along. So there was a question about server authentication, you know, doing a centralized authentication system. Somebody had mentioned OpenLDAP, and a couple of people voiced heartache associated with that. And then I thought Alex said something interesting. He said it's worth the Windows license have to deal with it.
Never,
dude,
never.
You can spin up a Windows machine with and have it, you know, DC promoed and like no time flat. So you could have
it. It's not about that. It's about securing it. It's about maintaining it. It's about, you know, one machine is never enough. You have to have high availability. You have to have redundancy, which means, you know, you have to spin up multiple DCs, replication breaks. You have to monitor all of that. It's not the license cost, and it's not the 15 minutes to speed up an AD DC. You know, it's everything else.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think everything else really takes much time or effort that you're not already doing anyway.
Oh, so first of all, it certainly does, because Windows updates are very different than Linux updates, and they tend to break stuff, as we know by Microsoft's wonderful history.
Never.
Also, yeah, right. Also, the out-of-the-box configuration of an AD/DC controller is just horrible. It's as bad as it can get. And like, there's been in, so here's another invitation to join our Slack. I've been posting a Microsoft specific exploit in our Slack security channel every single month. Like, there is one every single month. Just 2 months ago, there was one that allowed for complete domain takeover. I think I mentioned this on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that one.
Yeah, so there you go, right? You take 5 minutes to deploy an ADDC, and then, yeah, it will take me 5 minutes to completely take over that domain, right? It's, you know, it's also, as I mentioned, you have to completely implement monitoring for your Windows environment, right? Because when you have two DCs, you know, Windows replication breaks all of the time. It does. I've ran multiple bigger domains with even multi-site replication and stuff like that. It breaks all of the time.
I will counter that with, I walked into a client that had been running, this is within the past 3 or 4 years, still running server 03, multiple servers, everything worked completely fine, and I know they didn't touch it because it was still server 03.
Yeah, but when a security incident happens, you know, who will be to blame for the long end-of-life operating system and everything else, right? I think it's, of course, there is always risk running everything, and you have to either accept that risk or do something about it. For me, the risk is not acceptable to to run, like, you know, run stuff stupidly like that. But then again, I think listeners of our podcast know my philosophy on stuff, so I would never implement something unless I knew it well enough and was able to monitor it and support it and maintain it properly. And for me, Windows is just, you know, again, like, this is history. People can go listen to our previous podcast to know my experience and my history with Windows and Windows clusters and Windows servers and domains and everything else. And these days, like, as I mentioned in the last podcast, like, our entire company, even the desktops, are Linux now. We don't have a single Windows machine in our entire company anymore. And it just made my life so much easier.
Sometimes, Thomas, I wonder how long it takes you to figure out what you want to eat for lunch.
Which
restaurant to go to? It's got to be pretty taxing.
Nah, man, it's just you look at it, you pick one, and you eat.
Oh my goodness, let's see. let's give a quick tip, and then we'll go into maybe what might be a little bit more discussion. Jeremy from Australia, Perth, in fact. My hipster Slack brother there, he recommends not mixing UPC bulkheads with APC fiber. So the idea being APC, right? If you get an APC end, it's like it's an angled connector, right? Think of the A as like an angle, so the end of the fiber is angled, right? You usually use those on muxed fiber, right? So like you're doing DWDM or you're doing GPON, stuff like that, you'll see APC. Whereas UPC, that's kind of the regular flat polished interface. So apparently if you stick APC fibers and UPC bulkheads, you're going to have a bad time, and vice versa, because they're right there made for different tolerances. So keep that in mind next time. Don't think it'll be okay. Just kind of go ahead and order the right stuff. Not that I would ever do anything dumb like that.
And oddly enough, GPON network is not exclusively APC. Most of the time, the OLT is UPC. So you need to get at least one patch cord that's UPC to AC or APC. And then remember that everything else has to be APC.
Gotcha.
Or, well, has to match whatever you're plugging it into. I think the only thing that has to be APC is at the ONT, but I think it's just convention for everything else to be APC. But yeah, just have to match whatever you're doing.
Rock and roll. All right, so recently we got some REO Link IP cameras. We're just swapping a few out. They're really cheap. They're like $35 for like a 1080p camera. They seem to work fine, all right? There's not like a million features on them, but they work. They spit out an RTSP stream. We had an old version of Video Insight software in VR, and it just did not see these things at all. So the guys in the Slack recommended Blue Iris among some others, and we tried Blue Iris, and it was the NVR that supported both the new cameras and our ancient stuff. Some of that stuff, you know, it's like, it seemed like trying to look at porn in the 90s, like the way the screens would just like load so low res, slow motion. They're really bad. We're going to change those out. But they're in like very not important areas. You know, like watching the fridge to make sure somebody doesn't steal your sandwich. That's not the most important place to have a high quality camera. But the Blue Iris stuff, I think a 64 camera license is somewhere like $70 one time. So it's very affordable stuff if you guys haven't tried any, look at it. What are you guys using for your NVRs and IP cameras and all that stuff?
That's a sensitive subject.
Oh, okay.
I say sensitive because I'm currently using Ubiquiti Unify Video.
Oh. No, never. And, you wouldn't. Not with all the tracking.
And I. But I don't want to. I don't want to. But trying to find cameras that are not, Hikvision, or Dahua, or based on those two platforms, that aren't incredibly expensive, that don't have similar vendor locks. You know, Axis does have a cheap line called the Axis Companion. You know, Axis makes great cameras, you know. That's what I see all over Washington, D.C., back when I was there. For Nanog. But
why is it that you can't use the Hikvision and stuff like that? I know that like you can't use them in the government or whatever.
Right. Well, I mean, so there's a lot of them that have, you know, just ridden with security vulnerabilities, and you know, you just walk through, and you know, granted, part of that is, you know, lack of operator maintenance, but there's just so many of them so bad that have so many problems.
Hey, Mike, but you're using a Windows domain controller.
It's fine. I'm also kind of the opinion that, like, if I'm going to learn a platform, I want to learn a platform that I can use everywhere. So if I bring up a government client, I don't want to figure, oh, well, we know this Hikvision platform really well, but now I can't use it, so now I have to learn something else just for this client. And I don't want to do that. And so I'm still trying to find something that is, you know, that is not of those two companies. It's tough. You know, I hear people talking about it, and then I go look, and, you know, they love this brand of camera, and each camera is $900. I'm like, well, that's my Unify Video budget for the entire business, as opposed to one camera. And they're like, well, yeah, but you can do, you know, it's got pan tilt zoom. Yeah, but I can put up six Ubiquiti cameras instead, and now I no longer need pan tilt zoom. Except the problem is I want to stop using Ubiquiti because they have largely abandoned the Unify Video line, and it's not. You know, and they continue to go further away from any sort of standard. But, yeah, so It's what I use, but it's what I hate the most.
How about you, Thomas? I know when you're doing your MSP stuff, you guys did some large scale deployments. What were you getting dirty with? Or can you even talk about
it? Yeah. Yeah, in my previous life or previous work life, I did a lot with security cameras and with CCTV and everything else. I can talk about it. Sure, most of it anyway. We did a very large citywide deployment for the city police, which was citywide deployment. So there was a lot of cameras, a lot of NVR. There was a huge monitoring room with walls of monitors and PCs with 4 graphics cards, with 4 monitors plugged into each graphics card and stuff, you know, fun stuff like that. We did this for a long time. I supported that system for like 7 or 8 years. So we went through a lot of vendors. It actually started as a completely analog system because IP cameras were way too expensive back in the day. So we actually used analog video coax to fiber converters, multi-mode fiber, fun stuff like that.
Bali.
But to make the story short, what we settled on in the end was Milestone for the backend, and on cameras we used VivoTech and Axis for all the PTZ cameras, you know, the big expensive like $3,000 cameras, because this was a, you know, police department. They had requirements to have those PTZ cameras that were outdoor and, you know, IP66 rated with high temperature ranges and stuff like that. And yeah, those were $3,000 per camera, you know, and those had to be Axis because for the PTZ controllers, specifically when it's an IP camera, you know, the police departments have control keyboards for those cameras to move the cameras around, to switch between cameras. And you have one keyboard which has to support like 12 cameras. You have 12, you know, buttons 1 through 12 which select cameras, and then you have joystick to move around, zoom and stuff like that. And so support for that has to be built into the camera, to the joystick, and of course to the NVR to support pathing and just lots of stuff like that. Anyway, the point becomes, we went through many different systems. We started with some analog DVRs, then we moved to IP Corder, which is a company which no longer exists, sadly, because it was my favorite NVR ever. It no longer exists. You will not be able to find website or anything. Funny thing is, we'll still have quite a few of those running out in the wild. You know, you can't get software updates or anything for them anymore because the company is dead now. They got brought down on some licensing, intellectual property lawsuit. But it were amazing devices for their times, the NVRs. It was like a little 2U NVR that was able to support 64 cameras, and they were cheap and they worked really well and stuff like that. So after that company died, we switched all our NVRs to Milestone, and most of the cameras are VivoTech for the stationary ones, or if they just need zoom, just an optical zoom lens which is able to be controlled, and we still use VivoTech. And if it's more professional stuff, we go Axis.
Very cool.
I don't know if I've heard of VivoTech before. I just looked up one of their 2-megapixel bullet cameras, and I can see it for like $200.
Yeah, we still have a couple of VivoTechs running in our network.
Are they still reasonable cameras? Because
the ones we have are trash. Because they're so old. I'm talking like 10 years old.
Well, yeah.
So I haven't been in the MSP space and, you know, anything since I started Unimas. So it's been now like 4 years since I've left this particular, stuff. So I actually don't know anymore.
Well, but then, 4 years ago they were reasonable?
Yeah, they were reasonable. They had SNMP. You could monitor individual video streams through SNMP. You know, I'm a monitoring freak, so... Like I didn't know.
Yeah.
The first I'm hearing.
What? Really? Yeah. So they were good. They passed my standard. They worked and we were happy with them. They were really modular, and you could buy super cheapo ones all the way to high-end ones with, you know, interchangeable lenses and pluggable and connectable heating elements and all kinds of stuff. So we were happy with them back when I was doing all of this.
Excellent. Well, I've got a friend of mine that's going to be doing a Blue Iris Plus Reolink deployment that's got, I think they're doing like somewhere close to 60 cameras. It's at a vet clinic, and so they do boarding, right? So, you know, you're going out of town, you give them your pet, so they've got all these kennels, and they're going to have one camera per kennel, and he's developing an interface where they can log in remotely to see their pet or whatever, you know, to, I guess, make them feel better about leaving their dog while they go and have fun or something like that. So I think that'll be a pretty interesting he'll be definitely stress testing the software and see what these cameras can actually do. I'm curious to see what kind of capabilities he can tie into them. So I guess I'll give an update once he gets done with all that stuff. So
we actually had a similar application to this where we had some doctor's offices, and they were putting in cameras through for like elderly patients, and then they were giving links to like their people that, you know, their families and everything else, so they could actually watch. This was before GDPR, and when this was still much easier to do than it is now. But we had a very similar front end that you would just enter like a PIN code in, and it would show you the appropriate camera. It would just link in the RSDP stream to your front end depending on that, and it was just a very simple application, and it worked for a while. Anyway. Back to you, Greg.
Yeah, very cool, very cool. So we are at the hour and 16 mark. I've got a Dungeons & Dragons session to go to because I'm that kind of nerd apparently now.
Nerd!
They're waiting on me. I'm going to be a little late too. They're going to continue to wait apparently. They're the guy's wife is a dungeon master, and she writes like young adult fiction stuff, but she like knocks stuff out just like off the cuff. It's amazing. It's like super fun, and they are idiots, so it is like so hilarious. It's just some of the scenarios we get ourselves into. So Thomas, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they go about that?
As usual, just Google for me. I'm on all the social networks and platforms and everything else. Of course, there is always Unimus. There is live chat. Just ask for me. I'll be there.
Yeah, go to Unimus.
Are you on TikTok?
Oh, okay. You got me there.
Oh, that's sad. Mike, if people are going to get a hold of you, how would you have them do that? Now that you're tail end of the whooping cough, or you seem like you're doing all right. I see you keep muting.
It's still there, but it doesn't tremendously affect my day-to-day anymore, but it's still there.
That's good.
If you want to contact me, go to the Little Brothers Wisp Slack so that someone else can help you. Because even though, I'm still like at least 6 months behind on my work.
Well, by the by, I saw that Unimus recently started supporting SFPs just for you, Mike.
I did, and I was sitting there like, I have so many things to do, and I see... And I see that you were all dropping the Slack, and I'm like, oh, God damn it, I have to do this. I have to do this now. I can tell you that it still works, because the server's still running. I still get alerts from it. I haven't bothered to check any of the new features yet, but other than the Easter egg.
Yeah. Just for you, bud, just for you. All right.
Yeah.
If you want to get a hold of me, Greg at GregSoul.com. I occasionally blog at GregSoul.com. I've got a couple of new Lynda courses that are going to be dropping pretty soon. The new CCNA, I get to do it. Unfortunately, they made me follow the test outline instead of a natural flow of information, so it feels very staccato, and I'm not necessarily happy with it.
Crap.
But it's going to be more a Cliff Notes version as opposed to an educational track, so just keep that in mind, and don't shoot the messenger. It wasn't my decision to do this. Man... It makes me so anxious, because it's like it's not how I wanted it to be. And anyway, neither here nor there. If you want to really get a hold of me, the best way of doing it is on the Little Brothers Wiss Slack. You go to patreon.com/brotherswiss, sign up, support the podcast and slide into my DMs or Thomas or Mike. That really is the best way to get a hold of me. So I guess we will see everybody in 2 weeks. Maybe you'll hear me in a week if I'm just going to blast stuff. I won't call it the Brothers Wisp. I'll call it something else just so you guys don't get annoyed by it. But thanks, everybody. Questions, comments, please keep them coming. And thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Mike. Thank you guys for listening.
We got horrible jokes. We're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts. We're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry. You're forgiven.